Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 3rd. President Biden last night paid his respects to the remains of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, killed in the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Sicknick is being given the very rare distinction of lying in honor in the Capitol Rotunda, only the third private citizen ever to receive that honor after Rosa Parks and Reverend Billy Graham. When former presidents and other government dignitaries die, they call it lying in state. For the few private citizens, it's called lying in honor. Two other Capitol police officers who responded to the insurrection have also since died, but by suicide. And the FBI says 14 more Capitol officers were injured in the attack. As the country gets ready for the impeachment trial of President Trump next week on charges of inciting the insurrection, we'll focus more broadly now on how the wider investigation into the attack is going. How coordinated and pre-planned was it? Who were the groups and individuals who most contributed? Could it have been avoided? How to prevent more such attacks, which we know some people would like to carry out? With me now is New York Times Justice Department correspondent Katie Benner. Katie, thanks for coming on with us for this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And let me begin with the death of Officer Sicknick. I see that investigators are having trouble charging anyone in his death because it's unclear who in that chaos struck the fatal blow. What can you tell us? Can you summarize what is known about how he died?
You know, what we know is that he died while being confronted by a large group of protesters. And to your point, it's difficult to know if he died because he was engaging with the protesters. There were chemicals in the air, if he had a reaction to that, or if there was some sort of blow. What we have been told is he did not, as far as anybody knows, die of blunt force trauma. And we've known that for a little while. So that's taken that idea off of the table. There were officers who were hit, as we saw with hockey stick flagpoles, you know, fire extinguishers in the melee. But we do not think that that is how Officer Sicknick died. So if he died from some sort of chemical being released in the air, there was bear spray, as we know, that the protesters had on them, and sorry, the rioters had on them, and that the officers were using. They were using their own sprays and munitions. If that is how he died, it will be very difficult to assign that cause of death to any one person.
And the FBI says 14 other Capitol Police officers were injured. That doesn't get that much attention. And it also speaks to the amount of violence that was involved in the number of people injured, the number of perpetrators it must have taken to injure 14 different officers, and the number of separate assaults that must have taken place. What can you describe from what's known about the information that's emerging about the big picture there that involved attacks on so many law enforcement officers?
I mean, I think what we've seen that's very clear is that the officers were not prepared for hundreds of people to descend on the Capitol, to break through the barriers, and then to force their way into the building. They were not prepared for it because they did not have intelligence that told them that this was a serious threat. Even though they had intelligence saying that threats were all around them, nobody interpreted it or analyzed it and came to the correct conclusion that it would mean that the Trump supporters posed a serious and violent and dangerous threat. So in the overwhelm of the Capitol Police, you saw hundreds of people descend upon them, making it very nearly impossible for them to hold the line. We also saw from testimony that was given to Congress by the acting head of the Capitol Police that protocol was not followed when orders were given, like seal all the doors, that their radio communications were not working properly. So people on the ground didn't really understand the big picture of what was happening to them. They were literally under siege. And then in the course of this chaos, they were overtaken.
You've reported on conspiracy charges, and this is one of the most interesting emerging aspects, I think. Conspiracy charges against three members of the militia group, the Oath Keepers, and two members of the white nationalist group, the Proud Boys. They call themselves Western Chauvinists. That's their term for it, the Proud Boys. Conspiracy charges I guess, would indicate not just a protest that spontaneously got out of control and became a riot and an insurrection, but something planned and coordinated with that in mind. Can you describe the charges in each of those cases?
Yeah, so with the Oath Keepers, what we saw is we saw people, two people in Ohio and a person in Virginia communicating with one another, saying that they were basically planning to come to the Capitol and stop the vote. That shows that they were pre-planning their trip, they were pre-planning what they intended to do, and that they were, it was a coordinated effort. And that's the sort of thing that officials are now looking at, investigators are now looking at. If you look at, I guess stepping back, what we saw a tremendous number of charges and arrests for people who were trespassing in the building, illegal entry, stopping an official proceeding. These things were, they were able to very, very quickly charge. And once those charges were established, then the investigator's job, and this is why we've seen the pace of the investigation plateau a bit, was to start to make connections to see if there were more serious charges like conspiracy that they could establish. And so in this case with the Oath Keepers, that is what they found. They found that these were people who, that the government has decided, based on evidence, were working together in order to pre-plan an attack on the Capitol. And this is really important because it gives them what they're saying could be possibly even a treasure trove of information as they continue to investigate some of these far-right groups. So normally what we see is we see groups, we see white supremacist groups, we see militias speak on social media or in their private messages. And they're saying that they want to, you know, they're saying that they dislike the government. They're saying that they believe that the government should be overthrown. That is protected by the First Amendment. That is free speech. But now these are people who've committed crimes, which gives law enforcement probable cause to go beyond the free speech barrier and to start seizing communications, to start getting warrants to go into people's phones, start getting warrants to go into their email accounts and their other social media accounts to really see what's going on. And that, investigators hope, will lead to not only conspiracy charges amongst the group of people who attack the Capitol, but give them names and plans, people we don't know about, who might be planning other sorts of attacks, who they've been wanting to go after for a long time, but have not had the probable cause to do so.
So how do you see those conspiracy charges in context? Not much conspiracy and pre-planned violence, conspiracy by multiple groups intending to try to kill or hurt people or force their way in. What's the scope of the pre-planning with specific goals that you can say as a reporter with confidence that we know about, while they do the rest of the investigation with the additional tools that you were just describing?
Sure. I mean, I think that they're going to see more and more that there were people who were planning to forcibly storm the Capitol, and that is what they're initially going to look for. What was so strange about the attack on January 6th is that for many people, it was almost a crime of opportunity. There were if you pull... What we've seen are images of people in military gear wearing patches, videos of them giving one another hand signals as they go in, a really coordinated effort. But when you pull that camera back, you also see hundreds of people who had come down to the Capitol, probably not planning to storm it, probably not planning to enter. But when the dam was breached and everybody flowed in, they went in too. It's sort of what we see in crowd behavior. People were committing crimes they might not have normally committed. And so that is sort of the big picture. Law enforcement is trying to weed out those people and find those who, like Jessica Watkins and Donovan Ray Crowell and a man named Thomas Caldwell in Virginia, these are the three who have been charged with conspiracy, who, like them, pre-planned to actually break into the Capitol long before, you know, law enforcement is overwhelmed.
Katie, overall, your number is about 170 people charged with some kind of crime in connection with the riot. What do most of them tend to be charged with?
Most of them are being charged with illegal entry and illegally trying to stop an official proceeding.
Illegal entry and illegally trying to stop a proceeding. Relatively mild charges.
Exactly. They're relatively mild charges, though, that could open up the door to, again, more investigation. The other thing that the investigators are looking at are, and again, so much of this played out publicly because there was so much video of the attack, they're also really starting now to focus on attacks on the press. So we saw two incidents play out very publicly. A group of reporters near the perimeter of the Capitol basically physically menaced and then chased away from their equipment. Their equipment was seized and destroyed. We saw a video of a man trying to light it on fire. And then we also saw and heard the accounts of reporters who were inside the building who felt that they were fleeing for their lives. I will say one of our photographers at the New York Times, she was jumped by three assailants. They saw her press pass. They ripped it off of her. They ripped one of the cameras off of her body and stole it. They broke another one, and she had to flee. So these attacks specifically on the press are of great interest to the FBI and to the Justice Department for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, the First Amendment protects freedom of the press. These are serious crimes. Two, part of what we saw with the rhetoric that grew throughout the 4 years of the Trump administration was not only a refocusing of Trump supporters as pro-Trump but anti-government, which is something we hadn't seen before. It was a new paradigm. It was people who believed in this single person, not necessarily the U.S. government, not necessarily some of the norms and laws that had grown up around what it meant to have an executive branch. That wasn't what they believed in. They believed in him. So they came to the Capitol. They say they came at his behest to protect him and to prevent Joe Biden from taking his presidency away. We also saw them act out other things that he had talked about for 4 years, including thinking of the press as the enemy.
Can you go even a step deeper on that? These people who formed a sort of cult of Trump, as opposed to, you know, for a particular set of issues or a particular political party or for democracy itself, as you're describing it, what did they think he was going to do for him? I don't know if you've reported on it that way. But if ultimately belief in a leader gets tied to some kind of policy, or maybe this has just become completely disconnected from policy, what is it that these people with these hardcore beliefs in Trump think that he was doing for them?
I think that it's separate from policy. And we have written about this a little bit through the lens of the protests that broke out this summer and the way that President Trump and the top of his administration decided to talk about two very different groups of people we saw show up at the protests. You saw President Trump and his top law enforcement officials at DHS and the Justice Department speak again and again and again that the threat to the country was the left wing, was progressivism, was both progressivism as we think of it in the mainstream, so Democratic mayors and governors like Gretchen Whitmer, right? They were suddenly not just a political opponent with whom you don't agree with all of their policies, but they were actually enemies of the people. They were spoken about as people who were literally a threat to the country. And then the protesters themselves were spoken about as potential threats, specifically around the idea of Antifa, which is sort of a loose collection of people with far left ideals, and other sort of the idea of the far left as being a real threat to the country. But what's so interesting about that is they never spoke of white supremacists as a threat. They did not speak of militias as a threat, even though the FBI was seeing those groups show up at the protests, and even though the FBI and said again and again internally, hey, these groups are growing in real power and have been growing in power over the last few years. We are ignoring them in our rhetoric to the public. When you are a member of one of those militias or white supremacist groups, suddenly you see something you have never seen before. You see the President of the United States. These groups tend to be anti-government, full stop. They do not tend to align themselves with presidents. But you see the President of the United States suddenly saying the same things you are saying the left is going to destroy the country, saying progressivism is going to destroy the country, saying that they are the enemies of the people. You actually see a president whose rhetoric is aligned with many of the things you believe. And they actually start to see themselves, too, as the president's almost as his true law enforcement. They start showing up at protests to police the protests. They even start showing up at polls. We saw reports of that too when election season came. It's, you know, some of these folks showing up just to, you could say, intimidate voters, but they would say, we are protecting this election. We are protecting it for Donald Trump. And that is a very important, hard to overstate the importance of that shift taking us into January 6th.
My guest is New York Times Justice Department Katie Benner. As we look at what's known about the Capitol riot on January 6th, as investigators continued their work into the deeper roots of it, the many individuals involved in it, as you heard in Katie's last answer there, this informs the impeachment trial that will begin next week. And Carol in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Brian. I just have a quick question about the relationship between, I mean, is it true that the more you prove conspiracy on the side of the Proud Boys, et cetera, that might mitigate the charges against Trump of incitement to riot? And it's kind of a little curiosity question of this whole idea of it being illegal to call fire in a crowded theater. Is that a law? But what's the relationship between conspiracy and incitement? Thank you.
Well, that's a really interesting question. So on the first part, you know, I think that when you look at what Donald Trump is being accused of in the article of impeachment, he is being accused of telling a massive crowd of people to march down Pennsylvania Avenue and go take the Capitol, fight like hell for our country. Take it, you know, if you don't fight, we're not going to have a country anymore. So even if there were groups of people who came to the Capitol and those hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, these three people here, six people there, a dozen people there who had always intended to breach the Capitol, I think you could argue that the hundreds of people who we saw, including women who looked like soccer moms who were going on their way to, who could have been going to Costco after this, you know, families, large groups, religious groups who were going down to have, you know, to march and to pray, that those people were not originally conspiring to break into the Capitol. And so that is the bigger issue that I think that the impeachment managers are trying to highlight to the public, is that he asked people who would not normally do something like violently take a government building and send every member of Congress into hiding, send the top leadership, including the vice president, into secure locations for the continuity of government. You know, if Mike Pence had been kidnapped, if the leadership of Congress had been harmed in any way, it would have destroyed the continuity of the government of the United States. Now, what the impeachment managers are trying to tell us and trying to tell the public, who knows if they'll convince the Senate, if they'll convince the public, is that many, many, many of those hundreds of people would not have done that without the president's words and his exhortations. And that is the issue. We have seen again and again throughout the summer that there were going to be either militia members or far-right extremists who support the president, who do show up at his events, who did show up at the voting at the polls, and they did act kind of as like a shadow law enforcement. But this is very different. So even if they had intended to break in, that is almost beside the point. It's the other folks who never would have without what the Democrats are describing as the direct command of the president.
Linda in Jersey, you're on WNYC with Katie Benner from the New York Times. Hi, Linda.
Hi, I wanted to know how in-depth the investigation will be into the other side, the Capitol Police, the government itself that didn't anticipate this. Militia people have been around for decades, and they've gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. They are anti-government, not just pro-Trump. They are anti-government. And one of the things that always I go back to is in the 9/11 Commission, they came out and said what we did wrong as a country was our failure of imagination. Why was this not anticipated?
Of course, that's a great question. And I think there are a couple of things to look at here. One is that failure of imagination is probably the best way to describe what happened. We saw several pieces of intelligence coming up, flowing up to the Washington field office of the FBI in D.C. We saw intelligence flowing to Capitol Police, but it was the analysis of the intelligence that didn't rise to the occasion, right? So there were credible reports of extremists, of white supremacists coming, of people coming armed. But for a variety of reasons that people are still trying to determine, nobody read those pieces of information, pulled them all together and said, this is going to be a really, really big deal. We need to be all hands and to fortify this building as much as we possibly can. There are people who have already posited some theories. I'll throw them out there without saying, you know, whether or not I think that they are correct, because this is all still being investigated. It's very difficult for law enforcement to deal with a situation where the executive branch's own supporters, where the president's own supporters, you're right, most of these are anti-government people, but they are not anti-Trump. Trump is the president of the United States at that time. So to say the supporters of the president we need to treat as an enemy of the people, I think was something that I will say that law enforcement may have wrestled with for many, many months leading up to the storming of the Capitol, not just on, you know, in the weeks leading up to January 6th. You also saw a situation where we've seen some reporting around this. Law enforcement felt, possibly because of things like the Blue Lives Matter movement the fact that Trump himself was always very pro-police in his rhetoric, that this crowd would somehow not be as, they were less afraid that the crowd would attack the police, and that they were more afraid that the Black Lives Matter protesters would have attacked the police. And again, it's a failure of imagination, certainly. If at the very least, people have said that it's also extremely, it speaks to sort of it speaks to racism, it speaks to assumptions about, you know, what we think of as a violent protest. And then another thing that we've seen, that, again, these are all very preliminary investigations, is that the police themselves, once again, not only were they not prepared, it felt like nobody knew what to do when they were overwhelmed. So we saw video footage of officers trying just to get people out of the building, asking them really, really politely. And there's debate over whether or not they were doing that because it was one officer and 18 people and they knew they were overwhelmed, whether they were doing it because they didn't take the crime seriously. These are all things still being investigated. Now, in terms of the depth of the investigation, I think that what we're going to see is Congress is going to take the lead on oversight here. They already have. This is something very personal to them. It happened to them. It happened in their house. It is something that they very, very much want to get to the bottom of, and there will be very in-depth investigations. Hopefully, we will get something like a 9/11 report.
Katie Benner, the great Justice Department correspondent for the New York Times. Katie, thank you so much for so much information this last half hour.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.